Don McCormick, who is curator of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives and our host for this week's session.
Good morning. Welcome to New York and to the Lincoln Center Library and to New York's perennial April showers. Sorry for that, we didn't order it. I just want to spend about 2 or 3 minutes going over details about the building and the conference, local details, et cetera, to help you all out. There are four of us on the local area committee. You should try to catch any one of us when you have questions about the building or how to get somewhere or something about your registration or whatever. I'm Don McCormick. My assistant, Bob Kensler, is the young man in the dark suit that was at the desk when you came in this morning. Tom Owen, our sound engineer, is somewhere running around, is also on the committee, and David Hamilton, right over here, is the fourth member of the committee. So try to catch one of us when you have any problems or questions to ask about the next 3 days. The building is a public library and is open to the public today, tomorrow, and Saturday, so please be sure to have your name tags with you at all times. We have to police the people coming in and out of the auditorium. On this Amsterdam Avenue level, there are restrooms down the corridor, down the steps to the left, as well as public telephones. There is a small staff cafeteria on the mezzanine level, the next floor up from here. It says staff on the elevator button. You turn right off the elevator and go down to the end of the corridor. They can't accommodate large groups, but if you're in groups of one, two, or three, you can go up there for coffee, donuts, whatever you'd like. She's usually there at 8 a.m. I apologize to all you early arrivers today that she wasn't here until 8:20 this morning. The Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives itself is on the third floor of this building. There are a lot of security problems in New York and in this building particularly, and therefore the public are asked that they check their coats, bags, and all personal belongings they don't need for research on the first floor of this building. It's a free checking service, and I'm afraid the guards have been trained not to let anybody by with coats, bags, umbrellas or whatever, so you'll have to accommodate yourselves to that as well. We are offering guided tours of the archives this morning, tomorrow morning, and Saturday morning. Again, I apologize that they had to be squeezed in and scheduled while things were going on here in the auditorium, but you do have a choice of 3 different days to pick, and there's a sign-up sheet at the table in the front. This morning's tour is at roughly at 10 a.m. or as soon as the 9:30 speech is over. The tour of the Museum of Broadcasting this evening is free and open to all of you. You all have to find your own way there. It's on East 53rd Street, just off 5th Avenue. It begins at 6:30. There are travel directions posted on the bulletin board in the front. And again, if you have some confusion about that, ask any one of us at the table there. I have one major apology to make, and that's the tour of the Edison site in New Jersey. We never expected, first of all, such a large turnout in pre-registration, and second of all, such a large amount of people wanting to go on an evening field trip. It's never happened before in any arts conference. The Edison site could not accommodate 2 buses, and we had to limit the amount of people going out to 1 busload, and I'm afraid we're very oversubscribed. Those of you who have a red sticker on your name tag are already listed to be going. If some of you have sent in checks and had signed up for that tour and do not have a red sticker, it is because we had to name a date cutoff and we had already received more people than the bus could accommodate. Please see any one of us at the registration desk in the front sometime, preferably tomorrow or Saturday, about a $5 refund if you so wish. I would like to make one plea here, and that's for any of you who do have the red name tag and have been to the site before or find it rather easy to get there on your own at some other time, if you might willingly volunteer your seat on the bus to perhaps somebody from another country or the West Coast or whatever who would like to go and cannot go at this time. Okay, thank you.
I want to tell you that I'm might surprised to be standing up here. Fred Allen once had on his show a comic who used to say that he came from a seacoast town so small that the tide went out one day and never came back. I must admit I come from a bigger place, Cleveland, Ohio, and there on the shores of Lake Erie you don't particularly want the tide to come back. But regarding recordings, I'm just someone who likes to listen to them and has had the audacity of writing about them, reviewing them for a number of journals over the years. To have the task, and yes, the honor of introducing, not to mention cutting off when time's up, a list of prestigious musicians, critics, writers, and deeply knowledgeable collectors is enough to make me wonder what strange karmic turn got me into this role in the first place. There are many people on the 3 days program here who have given me much pleasure, and a number from whom I have cribbed now and then. I am pleased that so many have agreed to share their knowledge and enthusiasm with this knowledgeable and enthusiastic audience. And I'm sure we will all be more knowledgeable at the end of 3 days. I only hope that a few of us will be as enthusiastic. Of course, this program only vaguely alludes to the possibilities of what can and should be covered at a conference of people enchanted with the preservation of that most transient of art products, sound. Perhaps, having more lead time, I can do something about that for the 1987 conference in Washington. My theme for this conference was intended to be recordings as cultural artifacts, and to respond to the phenomenon that books are accorded so much more prestige than recordings, though Count Basie at Kansas City can tell us as much about his time as Jake Barnes can about his. But of course, such a theme would only be preaching to the converted at this association, and most respondents managed to pay the thought little heed. I have, however, out of deference to my original idea, and in respect of the man, sought out Andrew Porter to give the opening keynote talk. Mr. Porter writes for what may be the last general interest magazine, The New Yorker, of course, which accords sufficient editorial space for music, and which has sought out and supported so knowledgeable a writer. On graduation from Oxford, Andrew Porter was invited by Alec Robertson, editor of the Gramophone, to become one of the magazine's reviewers, and he subsequently wrote for the Gramophone from 1950 until he came to America in 1972. At that time, he became the music critic for The New Yorker, and 3 volumes of his collected reviews have been published from that journal. In England, he was also a regular reviewer for the BBC, and he worked with Desmond Shaw Taylor and Edward Sackville West on The Record Year II, and the big edition of The Record Guide. More currently, he has served on the editorial board for the new Berlioz edition, on the executive committee for the new Grove Dictionary, and is a founding director of the American Institute for Verdi Studies and vice president of the Donizetti Society. Additionally, he has translated some 30 operas, among them The Ring, Tristan and Isolde, Parsifal, and a complete Mozart cycle. He also indicated to me that he served as the studio director for Joan Sutherland's first record, an 8-inch bel canto disc. I'm very pleased to introduce Andrew Porter to make our keynote address.
New York has not been kind to the memory of Arturo Toscanini. Thank you very much.
Because I am a music critic who does insist week after week in the columns of the New Yorker, sometimes perhaps protesting too much even, on the importance of sound recordings, the importance in all sorts of ways for a proper understanding of music and for what music can mean to us. What I'd like to do in the next few minutes is simply to discuss some of the many ways in which I use recordings every day as a tool of my trade, and some of the ways, perhaps, in which other musicians use recordings, could use them, and should often use them more frequently than they do. Recordings as cultural artifacts is, as you heard, the general theme buried beneath the papers of this conference. I'd like to make it clear that what we're concerned with here is not just a documentation, an archive of past performances, but it's something that bears urgently upon present-day performances and present-day understanding, and is likely to become even more important in the future. And all the techniques and the disciplines that are going to be examined in detail in our subsequent papers, accurate identification, accurate and comprehensive cataloging, accurate reading of the documents. By reading, I mean getting them to yield truly and clearly whatever has been inscribed on their surfaces. All these things play parts in it. Let me cast my observations mainly from my own in the form of reminiscences. In the nursery, I had a wind-up phonograph and a miscellany of records that were mainly vocal. Melba and Martinelli, I remember, both made a deep impression on the very young Andrew Porter. But there were also two bulky albums, one an album of Weingartner's performance of Beethoven's Eighth Symphony, and the other an album of the Lehner Quartet's performance of Opus 135. When I reached the age of concert going, I discovered that there was more than one way of performing a piece, and that all orchestras weren't as good as the Royal Philharmonic, and that all string quartets weren't as sweetly melodious as the Lehner. And I learned the danger, and I hope I'm still aware of it, of judging musical performances with prejudice, with prejudgment that's been formed on the basis of the first performance on records of any work one has learnt to know and love. Well, soon Toscanini was added to Weingartner, and the Busch Quartet to the Lehner Quartet, and Arthur Schnabel set the standard by which most other performers of Beethoven's piano sonatas were found wanting. I'm possibly, even probably, still guilty of finding modern performers unsatisfactory on occasion, too precisely because they don't measure up to a Schnabel, or to the Busch Quartet, or to Hamilton Harty or Beecham in Berlioz, or to Furtwängler in Wagner and Brahms. But I'd hope not. At any rate, one guards against that. And at any rate, one is not an old fogey lost in golden memories which nobody else can check. If somebody objects to an opinion, all you'd have to do is to reach for the record on the shelves and say, well, listen for yourself and hear what I'm talking about. In that respect, let me pay a very warm tribute to the latest generation of skillful transcribers. I see some of them here. Those who've discovered new ways of making old records sound better than ever they did before. I had no idea, for example, that the Mapleson Cylinders, those live from the Met recordings from the very first years of our century, I'd no idea that they could ever be made to yield up as much information as they do in the splendid new collected edition published jointly by this library and the Metropolitan Opera Guild. Those recordings have space, some of them even have grandeur, and they're a wonderful document of style and manner from a vanished age. Technical expertise and historical detective work had to go hand in hand to prepare that issue. Without the detective work, there'd be many occasions when we didn't know who was singing what, when. Still, those Mapleson Cylinders do perhaps call for a rather, shall I say, specialized sort of listening. And what I'm really thinking of now are the recent reissues of orchestral recordings by conductors like Karl Muck and my old teacher, Albert Coates, which have now come out in better sound, in more eloquent and communicative sound than one had ever thought possible before. Recordings then set a standard for us, and through the ages, they continue to maintain that standard, and it's available for consultation by anybody within reach of a good sound archive. When I started going to concerts and compared what I heard there with what I heard on my cherished old records, it soon became apparent that style and technique were changing rapidly. One obvious example was the drying up of string portamento, which could still be heard in recordings from the first few decades of the century. I think Ormandy was one of the conductors who went on practicing it longest. Now, if Bruno Walter, who worked with Mahler, recorded Mahler's music with a good deal of portamento, and modern conductors recorded it with very little, then something had obviously gone wrong. When the early interpreters of Elgar's Cello Concerto recorded that work with wonderfully rich, expressive, well, the modern word would be swoops, but I'd rather call it portamento, And modern interpreters of the concerto played it cleanly and clinically, then obviously something had gone wrong. Tastes do change, of course, but recordings provide evidence of the kind of sounds the composer had in mind when he wrote his music, and in our age, which values stylistic authenticity so highly, or professes to do so, that evidence should not be ignored. I'm a critic who tries to cover a rather wide field of music, Bach today and Boulez tomorrow, Handel today and Hans-Werner Henze tomorrow. And so I seldom had time to go into these matters as deeply and as thoroughly as I'd like to and produce learned papers illustrated with many examples. But I do touch on these matters again and again, and sometimes these seeds lightly cast out do seem to have taken root and produced sturdy, substantial fruit. 11 years ago, for example, I heard a Traviata in Norfolk, Virginia, which seemed to me to be conducted with the stiffness and the squareness that most modern conductors do bring to it. And in the New Yorker, I wrote, "Again and again, I felt an urge to seize the baton myself and set more graceful and flexible tempi, an allegretto for the brindisi that would be lilting and graceful, at which the small notes had time to sparkle like little bubbles breaking, and an adantino for un di felice that ebbed and flowed and didn't fetter the vocal line to a precision beat, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And I continue, this is no special criticism of the conductor concerned, because one feels much the same at 9 out of every 10 Traviata performances one goes to today. Everyone, I said, must feel it who has studied interpretations of the opera closer to Verdi's day than to our own. Listen to the way A Forse Lui was sung by Gemma Bellinconi, a violetta that Verdi himself much admired. There's a letter from him to Bellinconi at the Scala Museum, which thanks her for putting new life into the old sinner. Listen to Dei miei bollenti spiriti as it's sung by Fernando de Lucia. Listen intently and after making due allowance for the individual eccentricities. Performers of 18th century music work hard to wring secrets of contemporary performing practice from the written evidence. For the late 19th century, documents in sound exist, and they are all too often ignored. Young American singers and most modern conductors are shy of portamento and of rubato, and they hesitate to depart from the notes that they see set out on the printed page, and so I went on and on. Those words caught the attention of a young musician who was living at the time in Norfolk, Virginia, as he told me many years later. He applied himself to a systematic and thorough study of the recordings made by the singers who were active when Verdi was active. The results of it, as I hope you all know, are now embodied at length in an article in the periodical 19th Century Music. It's an article that intelligent singers and conductors have to consult now whenever they are preparing a performance of a Verdi opera. And its author, Will Crutchfield, is a music critic on the New York Times today, who writes with an authority that many people twice his age don't possess, largely, I was going to say precisely, because through his work in sound archives, he has acquired a sound and solid historical perspective. Another related reminiscence. A few years ago, I was teaching a Verdi seminar in Berkeley. And I asked one member of the class to discover all that he could by listening to the early recordings of La Forza del Destino. He spent long hours in the Stanford archive. And he came up with some very interesting conclusions about style and interpretation. They were very convincing, and so they were put into practice in actual performances of La Forza del Destino that I worked on in Irvine and in Seattle. In fact, for the conductor and the casts, I prepared a historical listening tape of La Forza. Not for them exactly to copy, but to open their ears and their minds to the expressive possibilities that the modern world has largely forgotten. I know that Carol Vanessa's Leonora wouldn't have been quite so passionately moving if she hadn't been inspired by Eugenia Bozio's emotional, one might almost say extravagantly emotional, interpretation of the two arias. And with pleasure, I listened to the conductor of the show, Richard Bradshaw, persuade the Seattle concertmaster that the big violin solo would be twice as telling if he allowed himself an unabashed and lavish use of portamento. I spoke a moment ago about allied disciplines. Of course, all this recorded evidence does need to be weighed and interpreted carefully and sensibly and linked to the written evidence. For example, it's no good holding up Alfred Pickerwehr, Vienna's favored Puccini tenor, as a model of Puccini's style, unless we also take into account that Puccini himself declared that Pickerwehr's phrasing was much too square. The recordings made by the singers Verdi knew and worked with have to be interpreted along with the sharp and sometimes disapproving, sometimes approving comments that Verdi himself made about those singers. That's one reason why I admire Will Crutchfield's work so much. It doesn't make extravagant or unjustified or unsubstantiated claims. It weighs all the evidence in whatever form it survives, the singers' recordings, the contemporary criticisms of the singers, and the singers' and conductors' own annotated scores, a surprising number of which survive. These things all have to be taken together. In passing, I should mention two articles that interesting paper that was appeared in the Proceedings of the Royal Musical Association quite a while ago, which was based on orchestral style as discovered by listening to several decades of recordings by the Vienna Philharmonic. And I know someone in Berkeley is working on a study of Wagner singing, as it's revealed from the earliest recordings onwards. To stress the practical significance of all this again, let me mention the Act II of Parsifal that John Malcheri conducted with the American Symphony in Carnegie Hall earlier this year. To prepare for it, he'd carefully studied the way that Karl Muck and Siegfried Wagner and Arturo Toscanini used to conduct Parsifal. A little over 7 years ago, there was a revival here on Lincoln Center of Refice's opera, Cecilia. The heroine was played by Renata Scotto. And in a Times interview, Miss Scotto was asked if she'd listened to and learned from the Cecilia recordings made by Claudia Muzio. "Oh no," she said, "I never listen to recordings. They might influence my interpretation." Well, I think it would have all been influenced to the good in that case. However good, however bad, irrespective of whatever Scotto was doing, Cecilia was composed for Claudia Muzio. And moreover, the recordings she made of it are conducted by Refice himself. So it's rather as if a soprano who's about to sing, let's say, Verdi's Desdemona in a performance of Otello, and is offered a coaching session through the role with Verdi, were to reply, "Oh no, I wouldn't do that. It might influence my interpretation." Sensible singers and sensible conductors and sensible instrumentalists, of course, learn all they can from their predecessors. They have their minds and their ears opened to possibilities. They discern, they choose, they reject. And of course, they adapt what they most admire to the terms of their own personalities and techniques and practical possibilities. It's an arrogant, and I'd even say a stupid artist, who declares that she or he has nothing whatever to learn from her or his great predecessors. I remember playing Rosalia Chalia's records many, many years ago to a young Australian soprano, and I remember well Joan Sutherland's delight and excitement as she discovered just what velocity the human voice could be capable of. She felt inspired, not intimidated. Perhaps I've said enough, even too much, about singing. Record collectors are often, and not altogether, unjustly accused of being, above all, voice fanciers. I still blush when I remember an afternoon in an English country house when Aaron Copland came into a room and found Desmond Shaw Taylor and me, who should have been concerned with much higher things, eagerly comparing the merits of two pressings of Alma Gluck's Listen to the Mockingbird. We were listening for clicks and talks and wear, and deciding which of the two copies Desmond would keep himself and which one he would give to his apprentice. So let me quickly mention just some of the other ways in which a working music critic depends upon and uses recordings. My first regular employment, as you heard, came as a critic for a reviewer for the magazine The Gramophone. That was back in 78 RPM days, when one could write a column or two about a single 10-inch record, which might contain two songs, might even just contain one long song divided across the sides. Happy days they were. What one learnt from that kind of writing was to be detailed and also to be accurate, because one wasn't writing about a concert that had been and gone. One was describing something that any reader could check for himself and recheck and recheck. It was good discipline. It instilled critical accuracy. It inhibited rashness. Second, a word about the word, the spoken word. A year or two ago, when I knew that I'd be reviewing Elliot Carter's song cycle on Robert Lowell poems, In Sleep, In Thunder, I felt I had to get the sound of those poems into my ears first. Carter knew Lowell, and therefore, obviously, he had read the poems with, as it were, Lowell's inflections in his ears while he composed the music. The inflections, the timings, the emphases. I felt that I ought to get to know them too, and not, as it were, read the poems to myself in a British accent. Well, Sound Archives made it very easy to do so. It's not hard to come into this building and hear the voices and hear poets reading their own poetry. It goes back a long way, of course. I'm not sure how much I learned from that famous old record made by Alfred Lord Tennyson. Half a league, half a league, half a league, onward. Can's right to them, can's left to them. But the last line, of course, does come over terrifically with a big emphasis. Then they rode back, but not the 600. I do know that I have learnt much. I've learnt, as a music critic, learnt much from listening to recordings by James Joyce, who has been set so often, and from recordings by Robert Lowell and many others. Third, contemporary compositions can be, to put it very mildly, can be extremely difficult to comprehend at a first hearing. Now, there are two views, perhaps, about what a critic should try to do. On the one hand, he can attempt to convey the first general impression of a work as it struck the public. And on the other hand, he can maybe try to go somewhat deeper into the piece, discover what the composer was aiming at, and maybe even try to assess how far he's achieved that aim. And that can only be done with many scores. I hardly even like to say scores, because scores sometimes are so extremely difficult as representations of contemporary music. That can only be done by listening again and again and again. Both of those two sorts of criticism have their validity. Personally, I'm more interested in the second kind, and therefore, I've always made the fullest possible use of sound recording in whatever form it's available. When I worked in London, where most important premieres are broadcast live, I'd of course simply set the tape recorder on the timer before I went off to the concert so that it would be waiting for me, more performances, as many as I wanted, when I got back. Here in New York, that isn't always possible. But for such a piece as Pierre Boulez's Réponse that was played here the other day, I did, of course, cultivate the acquaintance of my friendly neighborhood pirate. I don't know whether what I wrote about Réponse was as sensible or not, but I do know that if I hadn't been able to hear it several times running, what I did write would probably have been the merest fudge. As a critic, I say I use recordings all the time, and not only for the actual events that are the first subject, but also to learn more about the composers I'm writing about. There's a very concrete example fresh in my mind. The proofs are waiting for me at home. In next week's New Yorker, I'm writing about a work, reviewing a work by Robert Saxton, which had its local premiere in Brooklyn from the Philharmonic, Brooklyn Philharmonic, last week. Now, Saxon is a composer who interests me. And in the international press, I'd read that his most arresting composition so far was a piece that had its premiere in London last month. Saxton is one of those lucky contemporary composers who has a go-ahead and supportive publisher. It's J.W. Chester. And J.W. Chester lost no time in providing me with a tape and a score of that work that had been played in London. And so, in reviewing the Brooklyn performance of the older piece, I am able to take into account the latest composition of Robert Saxton and relate the two. I've gone over 9:30, so how shall I sum up? Perhaps like this, and I hope I'm not going to sound too highfalutin, that art, poetry, music, painting, drama, dance, that art alone can enable us to make some sort of sense of life's tangles and troubles, that it links minds from age to age and makes Homer, Shakespeare, Goethe, Mozart, Beethoven, living presences in our everyday lives. That the survival of artistic texts has always been in various ways jeopardized and precarious. We don't know what song the sirens sang to Ulysses. Plays by Aeschylus have been lost. The text of Shakespeare's King Lear is in dispute. We don't know how Mozart played his piano concertos. We don't know how Teresa Stoltz sang Verdi when Verdi himself was conducting, or indeed at any other time. But today, and for a century or so, we have had a means of capturing this precious artistic heritage more accurately, more precisely, and more eloquently than ever before. The varied ways, the multifarious artistic and technical disciplines that have made this great adventure possible will be the subject of our deliberations during the next 3 days.